Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, we've gathered here, I guess, individually for a lot of different reasons. We pray that your reasons would please supersede our reasons. And Father, some of us have come because we need to be encouraged. Some of us have come because we need to learn. Father, I just pray that you would please surprise us. And at the end of these 2 days together, we would walk away with a sense that you had us here for maybe a different reason than why we came. And that we would be encouraged, yes, and we would learn. But maybe we would have had a fresh encounter with the God who has gifted us to lead, and the God who has called us to lead, and the God who has positioned us where we're positioned to lead. Surprise us with your presence. In Jesus' name, amen. You may be seated. Well, good morning. My name is Andy Stanley, and I'm the Director of Ministries at North Point Community Church. And I'm just glad that you're here. We've been looking forward to this since last year. How many of you actually were here last year at the first Catalyst Conference? Yeah, about a bunch of you. Yeah, it's great. It's great. Well, you're in for a real, real treat. And I just have to say thanks to our worship team. Can you imagine? Just think how much better preacher you would be if you got to get up and preach after that every Sunday. You don't even really have to try that hard. It's my honor and privilege to introduce our first speaker for the Catalyst Conference. I just met Jim Kuzes this morning for the first time, but he has been impacting my life since 1988. And in 1988, a friend of mine, Boyd Bailey, who some of you know, went to the bookstore over at Georgia State University, and he came back with a book. He said, hey, this is a book that they're using in part of their curriculum in their leadership course. And so we began to read The Leadership Challenge. And let me just say, and I told Jim this morning, it completely revolutionized my thinking about leadership. In fact, the five things that we're going to talk about specifically from this book in these 2 days, I took those five things, and currently they hang in my closet on a bulletin board. They are in my desk drawer at home, and there's a copy in my desk drawer in my office. And since 1988, I have lived by the five principles that are outlined in this book. In fact, this morning I brought my original book in for Jim to sign, and as we were flipping through the pages, there wasn't much of a place to sign because I have filled it up with notes. The first time I read it, if you look at my copy, I marked it in yellow, then I marked it in pink, then I marked it with a black pen, and then I took notes with a red pen. In fact, this is probably the most read book I own other than the Bible. That's what an impact it made on me. And so this morning, as I introduced him, I wanted you to know the significance of what you're about to hear. The thing that makes Jim and his partner so unique in their writing on leadership is that what they share is not simply the insights of a couple of people on leadership. What you're going to hear this morning and what's contained in their books is years and years of research talking to dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of leaders, pulling that information together, and that's why what you're going to hear this morning is so incredibly helpful. In fact, for years, when people ask me, hey, Andy, what's your definition of leadership? I've quoted from the Leadership Challenge that leadership is the art of getting other people to want to do what I believe needs to be done. Beyond simply his influence in my life, the accolades go on and on and on. But most recently, Jim and his partner were honored by the International Management Council as the 2001 recipients of the prestigious Wilbur M. McFreely Award. Now, I have to be honest, when I heard about the award, I thought, wow, what's that? But listen to who the past recipients of this award were. Peter Drucker, Lee Iacocca, Tom Peters, Ken Blanchard, Norman Vincent Peale, and Stephen Covey. So what you're going to hear this morning is as current and as relevant as it's going to get when it comes to leadership. So please give a big Catalyst welcome to Jim Kuzes. Jim.
Good morning. I have to add one other thing two other things, Andy's gracious introduction. Thank you very much for that. My mother would not be more proud. I started doing this work in 1969, and my first job was going around the South and the Southeast of the United States to various cities such as Little Rock, Arkansas, or Austin, Texas, Houston, Texas, Oklahoma City, Tulsa, various places in this part of the country. And my most memorable experience in doing management and leadership training for community action agencies, War on Poverty, back in those days, was when he arrived in a small town in the East Texas area, near the border of Arkansas. Any of you been in East Texas in this room? So you can picture that, right? For those of you who haven't been there, it's not like West Texas where it's hot and dry. It's humid and it's humid and damp and it's lush and green and lots of bugs and mosquitoes. A lovely place. So I arrived to do this training program. And now if you're in East Texas, near the border of Arkansas, the local community church is likely to be what denomination? Baptist, of course. It's Baptist country. So we arrived in town, and as was usual for our training, we would go to community centers and churches to provide the training because that was where much of the War on Poverty Community Action Agency civil rights movement was born. So we would train there in helping people to develop their community organizations. So I went to the church and I asked them where I should go for the seminar, and they said to the sanctuary. So I went to the sanctuary and I said, where should I stand? And they pointed to the pulpit. Now you see, I grew up Methodist. Thank you. There are probably one or two of us in here. I grew up Methodist. Now, Methodists and Baptists, they may share the same faith, but not exactly the same behavior, you know what I'm saying? So I walked up to the pulpit of this Southern Baptist church, and I started to train, well, to the congregation, my trainees. John, I don't know if you've ever had this happen to you, but to those in the congregation, this wasn't training, you have to understand. It was not training. To them, it was just another Sunday. So as I started to talk about interpersonal communications and team building and being supportive to each other and things like that, something happened that doesn't happen to a Methodist when he's at the pulpit. Now, can you imagine what happened to me back then? This is 1969. The congregation started talking back to me. I thought I was there to talk to them, but they were talking back to me. Now, if you were there in that 1969 Baptist church in East Texas, what might they have said back to me? Amen, or preach on, or
tell it.
Tell it. So if at any time this morning you feel so moved, I'd feel right at home back to 1969. Absolutely true story. Of course, If my partner Barry were to add anything to Andy's introduction, it would have to be that he would tell you I am a model speaker. Of course, if you knew Barry, you'd knew that when you'd look up model in the dictionary, it would say noun, a small replica of the real thing. But I think John would probably agree with me that those of us in this work do talk about models. We build models. The real people who do the real thing are those of you in this room. So I think I'd like to give all of you a round of applause. Would you do the same for all the leaders in this room, please? Really, truly, honestly. You are the source of our inspiration. Now, I'm going to share a few slides with you. You do not have copies of these in your materials. But in the flap in the very front, there's an outline of the model of your brochure, if you all have it, that orange covered. This being Halloween, orange, good color. Right here in the inside flap, you see this? You can write on there, or there's some blank pages in here. I'm going to go through a series of slides that describe to you the five practices of exemplary leadership. But before I do that, let me give you an overview of my talk. First, we're going to talk about the foundation of what leadership is, then the five practices. And if you stay till the very end, I have till 10 after 10, according to the clock on the wall, I'll tell you the secret to success in life, as was told to me by Major General John Stanford, who was in the U.S. Army at the time and moved on to become Chief Administrative Officer of Fulton County. Are we in Fulton County? Yes, we are in Fulton County. And then he moved on to become Superintendent of Schools, Seattle Unified School District. But let's talk about the foundational elements first. The first point is this: leadership is a relationship. Now, I'd like you to go down this list. It's in alphabetical order. This list was given to 18 to 32-year-olds, so there are probably some of you in that age range in this room, by a group called Public Allies, doing research on what young people thought about leaders and leadership, and they gave them this list. And they asked them from this list, from which one category would you say your most important leadership role models have come from? Business leader, community leader, which would include religious leader, entertainer, family members, political leader, professional athlete, teacher, coach, or I don't have any role models. None of these categories fit for me. So as you look at this list, just tell me which one would fit for you. Where would you find your most important leadership role model from which of those categories? Teacher? Business leader? Family. How many of you, let's take those three, how many of you, just raise your hand so everyone else could see, would say family member? You look around, you can see what the hands are. How about business leader? Fewer hands. How about a community leader, religious leader, somebody in civic life? More hands. How about a politician? One hand. How about an entertainer? A couple of hands? Yeah. Well, every category got some votes, but I'm going to show you the percentages of who got the most votes, and there's a lesson here for all of us in this room. Family member was first with 40%, followed by teacher or coach. I forgot to ask. How many of you would say teacher or coach? Looks like the second most. Family members, from the hands raised, would you say family members was the most hands raised in this room? Followed by teacher, coach, 26%, followed by community leader, religious leader, someone in the civic life. And if you add 40, 26, and 11, what do you get? 77%. Now, I speak mostly to corporate audiences. And I got to tell you, they're not anything like you. I'd love to take you with me everywhere I go, including the music. Because this is how people ought to be when they come and hear somebody talk. It ought to be a joyful experience, don't you think? Absolutely. Well, 77% of our role models come from family, come from teacher or coach, or come from our community life. What's the message there? What's the message inherent in what young people 18 to 32 years old are asking for? What are they telling us? What are you telling us? All of a sudden, you got real quiet. It's about relationships. They want relationships with their parents, they want relationships with their teachers and coaches, and they want relationships with their people in the community. While their mother or father may have been a business leader and a manager, and managers did get about 7% of the votes, those are not how they identify those individuals. They identify them as a parent. They identify them as a community leader. They identify them as a teacher or a coach. One of the things that I'd like to impress upon everyone in this room is that all of us, regardless of our life, all of your parishioners, all of your colleagues are leaders or potential leaders in the eyes of their children and other family members. Therefore, we all each need to take leadership personally. Leadership is everyone's business. It is not just the business of people with titles, whether they're ministers or whether they're chief executive officers. Leadership is everyone's responsibility. And if we want better leaders in this world, what better place to start than the home? And the schools. And the churches. And mosques and synagogues that people go to worship. What better place to start than those places? Because that's where we're all introduced to what leadership is. Now, it's not just in the community, and it's not just young people. If you ask older people why they leave companies, people don't quit because they don't get enough money. They don't quit because their IPO all of a sudden went bad. They don't quit because they don't get a car. They don't quit because their working conditions are poor. They quit because their immediate manager doesn't treat them right. That's why the majority of people quit companies. Some people say it's 71%. Other people say it's a little bit less. Here's some data just to show you what some people say. If the supervisor rating is excellent, the likelihood people will leave is only 11%. But if the supervisor rating is poor, the likelihood that people will leave is 40% on a voluntary basis. Not because of money, not because of perks, but because of how they're treated by that person. Therefore, it's not only important that all of us become leaders, it's important that all of us become excellent, exceptional, extraordinary leaders if we want to retain people in our organizations. The same is true, by the way, of ministers and people in churches. Research was done using our five practices, the one I'm going to describe to you, and those ministers of large congregations who use them more than those who use them less get more money in the collection plate, have fewer members leave their congregations on a voluntary basis, and actually grow their churches at a faster rate than those who do not use the five practices that I'm going to describe to you. So each one of us needs to take this personally, whether it's as a family member, whether it's a teacher or a coach, or whether it is as a leader of a large organization. So, if leadership is a relationship, what do we look for in that relationship? Now, I'm going to put some additional information up here and ask you to read this out loud with me in alphabetical order. Here is a list of qualities we gave people, and we asked them to go down this list and select the seven they most looked for and admire. Read out loud, if you will, the first one you come to that gets 51% or more of the votes. The first one in alphabetical order with 51 or more is competent. The second one is forward-looking. The third one is honest. And the fourth one is inspiring. Those are the four and only four. I just recalculated this data for the last 2 years for the revision of the Leadership Challenge. The data is exactly the same in terms of the top four. And the only ones that receive 51% or more are these four: competent, forward-looking, honest, and inspiring. Now, we asked people to check seven, so the others that got 40-ish percent are 49% fair-minded, 41% supportive, 40% broad-minded, and 40% intelligent. But the top four are these: honest, forward-looking, inspiring, and competent. Now, by themselves, this is a useful list. If you wanted a list of characteristics that would enable people to voluntarily choose a leader or select or elect one, this would be the list to use. November is election month for some of us. There are candidates running in New York and Atlanta. And here's a recommendation for you. Take a little 3x5 card. Write honest, forward-looking, inspiring, and competent on that list. Take it into the voting booth with you. Put it next to the name. Read the name, read the list, then vote. Are you a little cynical about that? But that is what we want. So if that's what we want, why not use it as a criteria for selecting leaders or electing leaders? Why, if every one of us went to vote with that in mind, maybe we could incrementally, individually, by our own little vote, change behavior. But that's what people say they want. Now, do they get it? Not necessarily. But that's not the most important message. If you look at this list, trustworthiness, expertise, and dynamism, this is the list of what makes people credible. Why people believe other people when they speak. When people are believed when they speak, they're perceived to be trustworthy. to know what they're talking about, have expertise, and they are dynamic and energetic. These three criteria for becoming believable as a public speaker, believable as a manager, believable as a newscaster, believable as your physician, believable to anyone in a message you deliver. These are the criteria that people say are most important. Now, I put them next to the leadership qualities that people look for and admire. What do you see? What do you notice? I made it rather easy for you, but what do you notice? Is it as obvious to you as it was to me and Barry that what people look for in a leader is the same thing that they look for in a credible source of information? Is that apparent to you? You see that? Well, here's the conclusion we came to then. It's very simple. If leadership is a relationship, the foundation of that relationship is personal credibility. Credibility is the foundation of leadership. Period. End of discussion. If you all went home now, I don't recommend it, but if you all went home now, this is probably the most important lesson from our research that I could leave with you. Credibility is the foundation of leadership. Or to put it another way, if we don't believe in the messenger, we won't believe the message. Does that make sense? Does that make sense? The first thing that's incumbent on all leaders then is to become personally credible in their own lives so that when they speak, other people will want to follow them. Leadership is about aspiration. We as leaders aspire to lead, but constituents choose, followers choose whether or not they're going to follow the leader. On what basis do they make that choice? Whether or not they believe personally in that individual. So if we're going to sustain leadership over time, people have to believe in us. Now, that leads me to a discussion of the five practices, the first of which is model the way. I'm going to make a direct link between what I just said and modeling. The second is inspiring a shared vision. The third is challenging the process. The fourth is enabling others to act. And the fifth is encouraging the heart. This is not exactly the order in which it's currently presented in the book, but it's the order in which I'd like to present it to you. Let's take the first one, modeling the way. What is credibility behaviorally? How do you know it when you see it? How do you know credibility when you see it? Anyone? You just see it. Okay, what's the behavior that you notice? Consistency, integrity. Consistency with what? So their words and actions are consistent. Now we have a lot of phrases in the English language that demonstrate this simple lesson. Practice what you put your money where your walk the or do what you say you will do, DWYSYWD, which is DWYSYWD for short. The definition of behavioral definition of credibility. Do what you say you will do. Now, there are two key parts. I've highlighted them in red and blue. The blue is the say part. It's your voice. It's what you speak with. It's your values and beliefs. It's the substance of what you have to say. And then what you do. And what you do has to be consistent. So let's take a look at the first part of this, the say part. Some of you may know Max Dupree. Max Dupree was former chairman of Herman Miller Corporation, and at Herman Miller Corporation, he wrote several books, and now he continues on in the not-for-profit world, doing wonderful things through his foundation. When Max had became a grandfather, though, he wrote about that experience in a book called Letters to Zoe, because Zoe, his granddaughter, who's now in her early teens, was born premature. Zoe was born premature, weighing 1 pound and 7 ounces. In fact, she was so small that Max's wedding ring could slide up Zoe's arm onto her shoulder. To make matters even worse for Zoe, the biological father had left the mother the month before Zoe was born. So there was Zoe in the neonatal intensive care unit, and when Max and his wife, the grandmother, walked in, they found her there with respirator tubes and feeding tubes and monitors all over her body. The attending physician gave her a 5 to 10% chance of living 3 days. But fortunately for Zoe and for the parents and for the grandparents, there was a wise and caring nurse named Ruth who came up to Max and said, "Max, for the next several weeks at least, I want you to be the surrogate father. I want you to come here every day, and I want you to rub Zoe's arms and her legs and her body with the tip of your finger. And as you caress her, I want you to tell her how much you love her, because she has to be able to connect your voice to your touch." It's a much more beautiful way of saying you've got to connect what you say with what you do. And Max said, without realizing it, "Nurse Ruth was, of course, giving me the best lesson for Zoe and the best lesson for grandparents, but she was also giving me the best possible lesson for the work of a leader. To become a leader, one need always connect one's voice to one's touch." "However," Max continued, "there is, of course, a prior task: finding one's voice in the first place." Finding one's voice in the first place. In order to connect our voice to our touch, we have to have something to say. And the more connected we are with that set of values and beliefs and what we care about, unless there's something meaningful in our lives, we won't become leaders who can be able to sustain credibility over a period of time. Arlene Blum was the leader of a team that climbed to the top of Annapurna. Annapurna is the 11th highest mountain in the world. She continues to lead those treks 25 years after she completed that rather noble feat. And she's often asked, "Arlene, why do you climb mountains? Why have you ascended all of these peaks? Why did you take a team of all women to the top of Annapurna?" And Arlene said, "Well, most people think the answer is because it's there. We did it because it was there." She said, "That's not why people climb mountains. People don't climb mountains because it's there. They climb it because it means something. For us, it was demonstrating to the male climbers who said it could not be done, that a team of all women could make it to the top of the 11th highest mountain in the world, that we could do that too. And so we did." And she says, "As long as you believe that what you're doing is meaningful, you can cut through the fear and the exhaustion and take the next step." I know all of us have been impacted by what happened on September 11th, 2001. My sister-in-law was on the 60th floor of a building 5 blocks away and witnessed the second plane flying into the second tower and escaped with her life out of there. I'm sure you have stories to tell too. What will enable us to cut through the fear that we now have and take the next step? The only thing that will enable us to do that over a long period of time is finding something meaningful in our lives. If we don't believe in something, if we don't care about something, if we don't find something valuable, we will not be able to lead our own life, let alone take others on journeys to places they've never been before. Can I hear an amen for that? Amen. Do you agree with that? That is what gets leaders up in the morning. is something meaningful and important and significant. Now, I'm a researcher. I have a university background. And my colleagues demand that we prove some of these assertions that we make. So my colleague Barry Posner and I and Warren Schmidt, we went out to find out when you're clear about your personal values and beliefs and something has meaning to you, what's the level of commitment that that produces to an organization? Similarly, we wanted to know if you're clear about what the organization stands for and believes in, whether it's your company or whether it's your church or whatever it might be, your not-for-profit organization, your school, your labor union, whatever it is, do you find more commitment when people know what they believe in personally and when they know what the organization stands for? The numbers in the boxes on this chart represent those levels of commitment people feel when they are clear about their personal, clear about their organizational. Now, look at personal values along the horizontal axis. And then look at organizational values on the vertical axis. Now, the highest number is in the upper right-hand corner, 6.26 on a scale of 1 to 7. The lowest number, interestingly enough, although it's not statistically significant, is in the upper left-hand corner. I'm clear about what the organization stands for, but I'm not clear about what I stand for. You can take a management team on a retreat and have them come back and post their values on the wall, make laminated wallet cards out of them, hand them out to all employees, make videotapes and play them at employee orientation, do training programs on what this organization believes in, but if people don't have personal clarity, you will not get more commitment when people are not clear about their own values and are not clear about the organization's values. In other words, all of that energy that goes into clarifying organizational values is a waste of time and money unless you are also willing to give people the opportunity to clarify their personal values and see whether there's a fit between the organization and their personal values. Values do make a difference in people's commitment to secular institutions. Interesting, isn't it? And yet you talk to most corporate executives and they think that's a waste of time until you show them that the level of commitment is highly significant and significantly different than when if their employees are not clear about what they believe in. When you don't work someplace where your values and the organization's values are consistent, you are likely to leave. Does that make sense? Now, what about adversity? John was making this almost an identical comment this morning, but Randy Melville made it to us when we were doing an interview with him. Adversity reveals character, it doesn't build it. What's going on right now with all the difficulties that we are facing is we are getting reintroduced to ourselves. What do we believe in? What do we care about? Do we have beliefs on which we can form a foundation? This adversity is not going to build our character. It's either there or it's not. What it's going to do is reveal it. And you don't want to come to adversity and all of a sudden realize you have no character and don't know how to respond. So one of the things that you and I can do to help people deal with these circumstances is to help them reveal their character. And where they may be weak, we have to build them up and make them strong. And when they are strong, we have to utilize those individuals to help us build others and to strengthen others. Adversity and value and meaning are directly related to each other. And how well we deal with the current adversity will have a lot to do with the strength of our character. At the Air Force Academy, just to show you this is true in lots of different institutions, they ask young cadets, AOCs, what's the most important quality in a leader? Someone you would want to follow as your squadron commander, called the AOCs. Air Officer Commanding. And these young cadets said officer role model was the most important quality. Officer role model. Those who scored high on officer role model not only had cadets who did better militarily, they also did better academically and athletically compared to those whose AOCs scored low on officer role model. The same thing was found in healthcare. When you model the way in healthcare, you are much more likely to have a productive group of employees. So whether it's healthcare, whether it's corporations, or whether it's the military, doing what you say you will do, modeling, setting an example, practicing what you preach, or as my deceased wife, who was from Texas, would say, honey, don't write a check with your mouth that your body can't cash. But you also have to be able to inspire a shared vision. One part of values is how we live our daily lives. The other part of values are those long-term aspirations we want to aspire to achieve. And so we also, as leaders, we find have to be clear about that. Gail Mayville was working at Ben and Jerry's when she made this comment. She's now moved on to work in environmental causes. But we did a case on Gail when she was at Ben and Jerry's. Now, Ben and Jerry's, you all know Ben and Jerry's, right? They make ice cream. Well, this may seem like a strange connection with values and with vision, but wait till you hear this story. At Ben and Jerry's, when she was working there as an administrative assistant in the office of the president, they had a problem. It seemed that the effluent coming out of the factory was so great that the local township in Vermont where the plant was located couldn't handle it because they were growing so quickly. So the local township said to Ben and Jerry's, listen, we're going to shut your factory down if you don't do something about this waste. You're going to have to figure out a solution to the problem. Well, of course, everyone was concerned, including Gail Mayville. Boy, if they shut this factory down, then we're going to lose our jobs, so we better do something about it. Now, normally, what would an administrative assistant in the office of a president do with a piece of information like that if she became aware of it? Tell the president, tell the manufacturing manager, tell the environmental manager, but not Gail Mayville. Gail remembered that she grew up on a farm in Vermont. And on the farm, there were some pigs. E-I-E-I. Oh, that's right. There were some pigs on the farm, and she remembered that she grew up on this farm with the pigs, and what do pigs eat? Slop, right. So she said to herself, well, maybe pigs would like to eat this ice cream waste. So she took this recommendation to the president of the company. They thought she was rather crazy, but Ben and Jerry's was a rather wacky company. So they said, well, let's give it a try. It's a lot cheaper than shutting the factory down. So they got some barrels. They bought pigs for the farmers. They put the ice cream waste in the barrels. They put the barrels on trucks, hauled them out, poured them in the troughs, and guess what happened? The pigs loved it. They loved this ice cream waste. They just ate it up. Temporarily solved the problem. They didn't have to shut the factory down. Eventually, they fixed the other problem so that it could deal with the growth that they were experiencing. But that initial solution helped them resolve that problem immediately. And when we ask Gail, why did you do this? Can we go back one? Thank you. One more time. There we go. There's the answer. Why did you do this? She said, well, for me personally, I am driven by my concerns for the legacy. I am leaving my children the environmental legacy. Gail had a long-term concern. She had a vision for her children. She had a vision for the way the world could be, and she acted on it that day at Ben and Jerry's by coming up with the recommendation that they buy pigs for farmers and feed them the slop. That's leadership, and that's acting on your future. I'm sure many of us have asked ourselves this question. I'm 56 years old, and I know you're under 40. So I've had to ask myself, and maybe a lot of you have asked yourselves, You know, since September 11th, and given everything that's going on right now, bioterrorism, what is the world going to be like for our children and grandchildren? Have any of you wondered about this? If there's any reason whatsoever to do something today about what we are currently experiencing, it is for the same reason that Gail Mayville did it, for the legacy that we are leaving our children and our grandchildren. That's why we should be acting today. Not out of my 56-year-old interests, but out of interest for our children and grandchildren. They will be living in this future that we create today by our responses to what's going on, both economically, politically, and militarily. That's having a vision. And when we have it, we have to inspire other people to share it. So I've chosen this Snoopy cartoon to try to illustrate it. He's obviously the leader. As you can see, he's got his explorer cap on, right? He says, okay, troops, gather around. And they gather around, and they look at the flag, and he says, well, what do you think? Woodstock raises some questions about what's going on here. And he says, who is it? It's me. I'm the leader. So I get my picture on the flag. Well, they look at it a little bit more, and he says to them, just think how it will inspire you as we march along. Woodstock again raises a question, and he says, well, all right then, does anybody have a better idea? I love this cartoon. What it illustrates to me is a leader has a vision of the future. But we're only going to get others to want to follow us if we can show them their picture in the flag, how they fit in to the whole picture. We can talk about what we as leaders want for the future, but until we can describe it in a way that other people want to join in and want to be part of it, we cannot inspire and uplift and get them to want to follow us. If you have a vision of the future, you have to enlist other people in it. You have to find a way for them to see the same thing that you see. Now, this is another magical process. And I want to show you how it's done because it's actually very simple. It's a very simple process. Let me just try to illustrate this. If you can bring a camera in here, I think I can do this. See this little now we want in this magic coloring book, this is how we want it to look. Can everybody see this? Or can we get a small camera tight in on this? You see that? Can everybody see that? All right, now sometimes though, it doesn't look like that. It looks like this. You see that? It looks like it's just blank pages. Now, other times when we're doing this, it just looks like that. Kind of black and white sketches. You can't quite see that probably. Now, those of you in front, right? You see black and white? So we can go from blank to black to color. Or we can have black and white. Now, what we want is this, but where we may start out is this. How'd he do that? Well, let me tell you how you can do it. I'm going to shout out the name of a place. You tell me what comes to your mind first on top of your mind. I'm going to say the word Paris, France. What comes to mind? Eiffel Tower. What else? The Louvre. Food. Love. Wine. Okay, all of those things come to your mind, right? The Seine. Rude cab drivers. All of those things flood into your mind. I'm going to say the name of another real place. You tell me what comes to your mind when I say the name of this real place, Tuva. Tuva. Yeah, what? Exactly. Any of you get an image? No. How many of you got an image for Paris? Popped into your mind. You know, probably nearly 100%. Of those of you who got an image, have all of you been to Paris? No. Not all of you have been, but you have an image. How can that be? I have an image in my mind of a place to which I've never been. How's this happen? somebody else showed you, described it to you. Maybe they brought their pictures back from a trip. Maybe you saw a television program. Maybe you saw some movies. Are you beginning to get the point? How do you get other people to see what you see or have seen? You show them a picture of it. You write a story about it. You make a movie about it. You talk about it. You tell stories about it. That's how you get other people to see your vision of the future. And when they can see it as clearly as you can see it, then they will want to follow you. But when they hear Tuva and it's blank, they're not going to want to follow. The magic in all of this is very simple. It's describing it in such a way, so clearly, so magnetically, that other people will want to go there just as much as you do. How many of you have ever been to heaven? How many of you have seen heaven in your mind? How many of you have a feeling about what that's like? How many of you would like to go there? Now, if I had asked you how many of you have never seen heaven and you raise your hand and ask you then if you want to go there, fewer people would raise their hands if they had never seen it in their minds. I guarantee it. In order to persuade people that they want to go someplace with you, they have to be able to see it in their own mind. Now, also, when we are positive and upbeat and magnetic, we undo a lot of negative emotions. We also fuel resilience. We broaden people's thinking and trigger an upward spiral as opposed to a downward spiral of into depression. We fuel an upward spiral into optimism and hope. And we actually fuel more productivity and make it contagious. At a time like this especially, we need to be positive in a world that is quite negative if we want to avoid the negative impacts of depression and giving up and lack of hope. Now I'm going to talk about the third practice. I was talking to a friend of mine, Elaine Fortier, who's Vice President of Human Resources at a dot-com company doing rather poorly right now, as you can probably imagine. And I said, you know, it must be really difficult to be in your fourth round of layoffs, wondering whether you're going to have a future. And she says, yeah, it's tough out there, but it's all part of the adventure. The pioneers crossed the Rockies in covered wagons. So I say to myself, this is really just a walk in the park. That's a leadership attitude. It is because people believe in something that when difficult times come, they know that what is rewarding gets done, not what gets rewarding gets done. Can you imagine being with a dot-com company where your IPO is worthless, you have two BMWs in the garage, a house with a mortgage you can't afford, and you're out of work? Now, how important was it that you sign up for the dream of becoming rich? I talk to a lot of people in those environments, and I can tell you they're reassessing their lives right now, because what is not important to them any longer is that worthless piece of paper that led them to join because they thought they might get rich, or the house or the cars. What's important to them now is that they do something that brings them meaning in their lives and they be with their friends and family. How do we know if something is going to be coming along that might change our lives, cause us to need innovation, do something differently? Well, as one Fortune 500 wag told us, the clue train stopped here 3 or 4 times a day, but we never took delivery. You know, isn't that great? I often think about this. How often do we know something's going to happen before it's going to happen? Don't we often know? Aren't there weak signals in the environment? Aren't there clues that something's going to bust before it busts. That internet bubble is going to burst any moment now. Aren't there signals way ahead? Like nobody can be worth 135 times earnings and be making no profit. I mean, that math doesn't work out. You can't multiply 135 times zero and get a number. The Clue train stopped here three or four times a day for several years and nobody took delivery. What we have to do as leaders is be willing to see what's coming along in our lives and be willing to anticipate it. Another thing we have to do is when we get our neck deep in a swamp, as this woman is in this swamp, an organization called Operation Raleigh, founded by Prince Charles to take young men and women around the world to follow the route of Sir Walter Raleigh to provide service to communities and also to provide opportunities for young people to grow as leaders. You have to have the expression and the attitude like this woman does. What's that expression on her face? She's smiling. She's neck deep in a swamp, but she's smiling. And if you had to draw a cartoon bubble over her head, what do you think she'd be saying to herself? Yeah, you can make up all kinds of things, I'm sure. But I'd like you to imagine this one possibility, you know? She says to herself, you know, if anybody had told me I'd have to get neck deep in a swamp in order to get through Operation Raleigh, I would have told them, no, I don't want to sign up. I don't want to get neck deep in a swamp. But now that I'm here and now that I'm doing this, you know, I can do this. It ain't so bad. And this smile appears on her face because she sees that she can do something she didn't think she could do. That's a leadership attitude. When you're able to learn from difficult experiences, as the highest performers have demonstrated in research that some of our colleagues have done, at University of Virginia, those with a learning mindset, those with a challenge mindset, are the highest levels of performance. In our own research, Barry and I have found that the leaders who score highest on all of the five practices, three of which I've talked about so far, those who score highest on those practices also score highest on learning. Leaders are learners. And when we're curious about the world, when we're willing to read weak signals and take delivery from clue trains, when we're willing to jump in the swamp and realize that we can do something from our own experience, we are going to be better leaders. And it doesn't have to start at an old age. Tara Church, when she was a young girl of 8 years old, started Tree Musketeers. They just planted their 1,000,000th tree a year before she went off to Harvard Law School. Started it at 8. At 9, Melissa Poe wrote a letter to then President George Bush, the elder George Bush, about her concerns about the environment. The president didn't respond to the letter. He gets a lot of letters. So instead, she had her letter put on a billboard in Nashville, Tennessee. A lot of people drove by, and they saw this on the billboard, and they decided to put it on more billboards and grew to 50 billboards and finally started 2,000 chapters with 200,000 members at 9 years old because they were willing to accept the challenge at that age. So it doesn't require people to be older. It just requires that people take action and seize the initiative. And you have to enable others to act. 18 to 30-year-olds, again, said that the top things they look for in leaders are, first of all, you can see the situation from someone else's point of view, and you get along well with others. A survey was done on the internet. I love this data because of how it was connected. A survey was done on the internet asking Fast Company readers to tell them what was more important to them, their success 5 years from now, internet skills or social skills. 72% said social skills. 28% internet, and it was taken on the internet. What's important to leaders is your ability to get along well with other people. Collaboration wins more often than competition. We're a competitive culture, but one of the lessons we have to learn is that teamwork outperforms individualistic achievement and competition between individuals. It's really teamwork that will make us successful in the long run. I want you to imagine you're the third person in line to do this exercise. How many of you have done something like this? Call the trust file, you stand on the edge of a ladder and you put your back to a group and you fall over like backwards. You're the third person in line. First person goes up as this individual has. Falls over backwards into the arms of the others. They put their arms up and catch. Safe, secure, the team has done its job, everybody applauds. The second person goes up to the top of the ladder, stands, falls over backwards, but the group forgets to do its job. Drops him down on the ground on top of the other person and they're both hauled off to the hospital. You're next. How are you feeling at this moment? How are you feeling? A little nervous? Lack a little trust? Oh, you go next. I'm sorry. People will risk when they trust. People will not risk when they don't trust. If we want people to do innovative, creative, new, and different things that challenge their personal skills and abilities, they need to be able to trust each other. So we can all put our arms up like this and catch someone consistently and expect that we'll all do these same kinds of risky activities. But when we can't expect that consistency, then we won't. And there's another lesson in here about enabling, and that is networks, networks, networks. It really is about who you know, not just what you know. How many have heard the phrase intellectual capital? And we live in a society now where it's knowledge society, and it's going to be what you know that is important, and it's knowledge and it's intellect that's going to get you ahead. That may be true, but I'm here to tell you that in the future it will be social capital, not intellectual capital, that will make organizations successful. That is, the denseness of the network and how many people know each other and are willing to support each other will be the secret to success in the future. As Dick Nettle told us, when the Bank of America was burst apart, when Nations Bank bought it and they merged, he lost his network and he had to rebuild it. Because he was an operating guy, he relied upon his network to get things done. Each of us relies on a network to get things done and relies upon a way of building other people's respect and trust for us to get things done. And finally, the fifth practice. And then the secret to success in life. So we started with modeling, then to inspiring, then challenging, then enabling, and now finally we're at encouraging. The fifth of the practices we found leaders excelled at. How many of you would say you need encouragement to get your best job done? How would you say you need it? A lot of you are raising your hands, but not all of you. When Barry and I started to do this research, we thought a lot more people would say yes than did. 60% said yes, they needed it. But being researchers, all you have to do is change the question to get a different answer. You know, we wanted to find out if something was true. So we tried to figure out what was the right question to ask. We ended up asking this question. When you get encouragement, do you perform at a higher level? Does it help you perform at a higher level? How many people do you think responded yes to that? 98%. as compared to 60%. I think it was the singing ahead of time that got me. 98% said yes. If 60% say they don't need it, but yet 98% say they perform higher when they get it, what's the message? They really need it, don't they? Why aren't we willing to say we need encouragement? Why aren't we willing to admit that we need it? Maybe we feel like we can't admit any weakness. We can't admit we need help from other people. We can't admit we need kindness and respect from other human beings. Maybe as leaders, we're too proud to say that we need your help, but yet we do. And when we get it, we perform at higher levels. Problem is that only 37% of people in this country say they get any kind of recognition at work. 44% say they never get any, and that's probably because under 50% of managers never give any. That's pathetic. Pathetic behavior on the part of leaders when 98% of people perform at higher levels when they get some kind of encouragement. Don Bennett was the first amputee to climb Mount Rainier, and he illustrates the power of this for all of us. He climbed Mount Rainier, this the first amputee, 14,410 feet on one leg and two crutches. When he was climbing it, he came to an ice field. And in an ice field, you slip if you don't put crampons on the bottom of your shoes. So on the bottom of his boots, he put his crampon. So he stuck his one crampon in the ice, and he didn't have another leg, so he couldn't stick that other one in there. He stuck the poles in the ice. So he's got one boot with a crampon and two poles, and this is how he is on the ice. Guess what happened? He got stuck. He got stuck. He couldn't move. It was there frozen in the ice. You see, two-legged people can put a boot in the ice and shift weight and then pull the other one out and do this. And that's how they get across the ice. Don couldn't do it. So what's he going to do to get across the ice to become the first amputee to climb Mount Rainier? The only thing he could think of doing was to fall forward and crawl across the ice, which is what he started to do. So there is crawling across the ice, and his daughter, Kathy, who was about 16 at the time, saw her father crawling across the ice. Ran down and said, "Dad, what's happening?" She thought he was hurt or something, and he told her the story. She said, "Well, let me get you some help." And she brought a team leader over who got an ice axe and started to chop a hole in the ice so Don could hop into this fresh snow and have some leverage to hop across the ice. While he was doing that, his daughter, Kathy, stood beside her father for 4 hours. 4 hours, and shouted one thing in his ear. "Come on, Dad, you can do it. I know you can do it, Dad. You're the best dad in the world. Come on, Dad, you can do it." And Don looked at me after telling me that story, and he said, "You know, there was absolutely no way I was not going to get across that ice field with my daughter shouting that in my ear." You want to know what leadership is? What she did is leadership. Oh, you can do it at any age. You can do it from any position. And you never conquer the mountain. What you conquer is yourself, your doubts, and your fears. As was told to us by another climber, Jim Whittaker, first American to get to Everest. The mastery of the art of leadership is the mastery of the self. The instrument we have to use is this. This is it. This is all there is. To become masters of the art of leadership, then, we need to keep one last secret to success in mind. It came to us from John Stanford, as I mentioned to you. If you have a copy of this book, it's in here. And I'd just like to read to you what he said. How do we develop leaders for the future? When anyone asks me that question, John said, I tell them I have the secret to success in life. The secret to success is stay in love. Staying in love gives you the fire to really ignite other people, to see inside other people, to have a greater desire to get things done than other people. I don't know any other fire, any other thing in life that is more positive and exhilarating a feeling than love is. A person who is not in love doesn't really feel the kind of excitement that's going to help them get ahead and lead others and to achieve. Now, I did not expect to hear that from a major general in the United States Army. But I thought back over all the interviews we've done and all the stories of a few of those people that I've told you. And it became very clear to me and to my colleague and to all of us that leadership is not an affair of the head. Leadership is an affair of the heart. If we can have love for the people we work with, for our constituents, for our customers, for our clients, for our parishioners, for the people around us who support us, for the products and services we provide, and for ourselves, we can get extraordinary things done on a daily basis. So thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. Love them and lead them. Praise the Lord. Thank you very much. Thank you all.